Well, near the end of both of their lives, the man who had been the second president of the United States, John Adams, wrote to the man who would become the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, and said something that when I first read it, jumped off the page at me. He said, "My friend, you and I have lived in serious times." Serious times. And he was absolutely right. A Declaration of Independence, a war with the mother country, the birth of a nation. But they didn't just live in serious times. I think what captivated me was that they had also lived very serious lives. And if they hadn't, the entire course of history would have been radically changed. It would have gone on an altogether different trajectory. Serious times met with serious lives. That's the anvil on which history really is forged. More important, it's the means by which the kingdom of God is advanced and the life of a Christ follower is measured. Our lives are meant to be weighty. They're meant to be consequential. They're meant to be serious. Not just some lives, not just select lives. Every single life, my life, your life. And that's critical to understand. And it's also, I think, what we most want ourselves. One of the things that I reflect on more now than I even did at the moment in my own life was back in the summer of 1980. I was out west in Colorado working on a project for a company my father was managing. I was not a Christian at the time. I didn't become a Christian until I was 20 years old. I took some time off one weekend, and I went into a nearby city, and I saw a movie that had just been released. It was the second installment of the original Star Wars trilogy, The Empire Strikes Back. And as I'm sure you know, the entire Star Wars saga is about the cosmic battle between good and evil, with the first three films focused on the young farm boy Luke, who becomes swept up in this galactic rebellion against an evil empire. Well, seeing that movie long, long ago in a city far, far away, at the tender age of whatever I was at that time, 18, 19 years old, was a very defining moment for my life. I remember to this day sitting in the parking lot afterward, and I was overwhelmed with a single thought. That's what I want for my life. That's what I want. I want to be caught up somehow in the sweep of history. I want to be in the center of things. I want to be making a difference. I want to be at the heart of the struggle between right and wrong and between good and evil. And I remember that my heart was almost breaking at the thought of a life on the sidelines, of a life of insignificance, of a life that wasn't in the heat of the battle. And then I recall thinking, where can that happen in the real world? How can I be part of something that is larger than I am? Where in life can something so grand be found? And then it came to me, even though I was not ready to accept it at that point, but it came to me at that point as a pivotal part of my spiritual journey. I think that's what God's invitation to the Christ life is about. What I know about it, I think that's what it's about. And if I were to ever choose Christ, I think I'd be choosing that great adventure. And within about a year or so, I did become a Christ follower. There is this galactic struggle going on. And I sensed I could be a warrior, that I could give my life to something that would live on long after I was gone, that was bigger than I was, and where what I did mattered and could impact all of eternity. And the reality of the spiritual realm, I mean, the struggle for men's and women's souls, the cosmic significance that was at stake, the consequences at hand, it just began to grow so clear to me. I could give my life to that. And I knew there was nothing that would ever compete with its scale of significance. Nothing in the marketplace, nothing in politics, nothing in any other field, nothing. Now, I'm not going to assume you felt the same way following seeing Star Wars, but I'll bet you've had some of those same feelings, or you would never have answered the call to ministry. You would never have answered the call to Christ. I mean, forget ministry, not even Christ. Maybe it was watching Braveheart. Maybe it was Lord of the Rings. Maybe it wasn't a movie at all where the stirrings on your soul began and you began to get a larger vision for your life. It could have been seeing Les Mis on stage or standing on the beach at sunset and just, you know, watching the sun paint its way out of the sky. Maybe it was standing on the crest of a mountain. It could have been the stirring of your spirit when you first read a speech by Winston Churchill, or you heard an altar call at a Billy Graham crusade, or you saw a clip of Mother Teresa walking through the slums of Calcutta. I think we've all had moments, just moments, where we were moved at the deepest and most emotional of levels to give our lives away to something bigger than we are, to make a difference, to change the world. Now, what's sad is that for an awful lot of us, it ends right there. The feeling comes, and then it fades. And we end up, you know, trading making history with making money. And we substitute living for God with living for the weekend, with building a life, with building a career. Not because we want to, but because we don't really know how to have it be any other way. There's no real sense of where the battle rages. We don't really know even sometimes what the battle is about. And even if we did know, we don't know what it would take to really suit up and go to war. We admire the ones that have. We make them our heroes, but we're clueless as to how they actually got into the heat of the battle, how they made their mark and their difference. We don't know what it takes to lead the kind of life that does make the difference that we long for. And so you look all across the landscape and you see Christians who are saved, but they're not seized. And you see Christ followers who have been delivered, but they're not driven. It doesn't have to be that way. In fact, that's not the call in our life. I think sometimes we've made the words of Jesus very tame when he said, be the salt of the earth, be the light of the world, and let that light shine. We make it into little children's songs and neat little metaphors. We don't realize the incredible radical revolution that Jesus was wanting to unleash by saying those words to us. And it is a radical revolution. You know, it's almost become cliche to talk about seizing the day as if it was little more than savoring a moment. For Jesus, seizing the day meant respond to the challenge that is before you. Respond to the challenge that you've got. In the ancient scriptures, there was a group of men known as the men of Issachar, one of those obscure, throwaway little lines in a whole set of listings I remember when I read it the first time, I thought, whoa, 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 whoa. There's something said about these men that's different than what is being said about everybody else in this listing. And if you read it in 1 Chronicles 12, you see that when it comes to the men of Issachar, it says, the men of Issachar, and it's almost like it says, okay, pause right there. These were the men who understood the times, the Bible says, and knew what Israel should do. These were the men who understood the time, the day, and knew what Israel should do. That's the combination we've got to pursue, to deepen our awareness of what is happening in our world, the flow of history to this point, and the pivotal moment that our day represents, and then explore the key areas of life that need to be developed in order to live a life of consequence. That's the challenge of discipleship. Don't make it toothless. Don't make it gutless. Don't make it spineless. It's the challenge of being in the vanguard of the assault. That's the challenge of discipleship. Heaven forbid it's ever for our own spiritual self-fulfillment. It's for the war. It's for the war. And doing it now matters more than ever. One of the more intriguing observations about the flow of history surfaced in a very important essay that was written right after the Second World War that I came across while I was doing some studies in Oxford. And it was required reading there because they had so elevated the importance of this particular essay, but it really went virtually unknown in the United States. It was written by an historian named Christopher Dawson, who I found out later was a very devout Christian man. And he suggested that there have been six identifiable ages in relation to the Christian church, each one lasting three or four centuries, and each one following a similar course. He contended that each one of these ages that you can chart all of Christian history from began and then ended in crisis. And the heart of each crisis was intense attack by new enemies, both within and from outside of the church, which forced the church to have new spiritual determination, new spiritual drive. If it didn't have that determination and drive, the church would have lost the day. all would have been lost. Now, Dawson accounted for six such ages at the time of the writing of his essay. I am absolutely convinced we are now living during another. We're at the end of an age, and we stand at the beginning of another, which is why leading a life that matters now is more critical than at any other time in recent memory. And perhaps more than any of the other junctures or crisis moments in all of Christian history for the church. And here's why. Let me just put out a thesis, accept it or reject it. I believe that there has been a second fall. Now, the first fall led to God's expulsion of human beings from the Garden of Eden. The second fall was when we returned the favor. In our world right now, most leaders of science and commerce, education and politics, they have ceased operating with any reference to a transcendent truth, much less a God. This is a very new and profound break with history, with the entire flow of Western thought and culture. I mean, when you trace it back, even among those times and places that we might call pagan, true secularity never existed. Because whether it was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or the gods of Greece and Rome, there were gods. There was a transcendent realm. There was something outside of our context, and you lived in light of it. Nobody would have thought of beginning with themselves alone and then try to develop truth, try to develop morality, and go into self-government. The second fall changed all of that and now shapes the world in which we live. And this is where it's important, I think, to understand the flow of history. And if you'll allow me to do it, let me take you on a bit of a whirlwind tour, because it's important to understand the context of our modern day. The Western world begins with the medieval. You know, I could take a lot of time, but I think I could make a strong case for that. Someone go back to Rome or Greece. I think our actual Western culture really did begin with the medieval. And the medieval world was a profoundly Christian world. There was nothing and there was no action that was not put in relationship to Christ and faith. So while it may not have been a golden age of Christianity, we shouldn't romanticize it, and while men and women still sinned and fell short of the glory of God, many without shame, they knew they were falling short. That's pretty critical. They knew they were falling short, and of what? And most importantly, whom? It never entered anybody's mind to establish a secular society. Throughout the Middle Ages, the politics, the learning, the social organization, the art, the music, the economics, the law of Europe, it was Christian. The vision that everybody had collectively was of a Christian society. They might have quibbled about what that meant, but the vision was for a Christian society and to live and to act and to think Christianly within it. That was the beginning of our culture. Well, then came the Renaissance. And as the word itself means, the Renaissance was a rebirth. It was seen as a return to the learning and knowledge reflected in ancient Greece and Rome. It was a turn from the medieval focus on the world to come to a fascination with the world at hand. From the Renaissance came the creation of what many have now called, and many at that time did too, humanism. As the name implies, much of this was just a celebration of the humanities, a celebration of humanity itself. And at first, it was a Christian humanism. It was a sacred humanism. Only when humanism became ripped from its Christian foundation, its Christian moorings, and became a secular humanism, when humanism became, as Francis Schaeffer once wrote, autonomous, meaning divorced from the biblical revelation and a Christian worldview, only then did it become destructive. Instead of studying man in light of the Creator, which is a wonderful thing to be a Christian humanist, it was more of a turn to Plato's idea that no, man is the measure of all things. And that was a radical reversal of medieval understandings. So with man as the measure of all things, as opposed to God, what kind of world would there be? Well, many rushed to say, well, it would be only an enlightened one, a wonderful one. And thus came what we now do call the Enlightenment that sprang from the Renaissance when humanism ceased to be Christian and became secular. It brought us that period we know as the Enlightenment. Now, to properly understand the Enlightenment, you have to see it as not so much an age. The more I study on it, I reflect more and more that it really is more of a spirit. A spirit. Rather than returning to revelation, there was a return to reason as the surest and best guide for humanity. The motto of Immanuel Kant, arguably one of the most significant thinkers of the time, was dare to use your own reason. Or more simply, as he said in many of his writings, just dare to know. Dare to know. The fundamental idea was that there was something there to know in and of and by ourselves. We could begin with ourselves and gain the means by which to judge all things. And not only that we could, but that we should. So the issue, very quickly, was never about the Enlightenment's relationship to religion, but about the Enlightenment as a religion. So much so that many historians reflect on the period of the Enlightenment, and they say that was the rise of modern paganism. That's where it began. Now, the speed by which Enlightenment thinking took hold is nightmarish and breathtaking. By the end of that era, when the church had reigned supreme for over a millennia, by the end of that short era, the church had been marginalized. Theology had been dethroned as the queen of the sciences. The Christian worldview was reduced to a fading memory. And for the first time since the 4th century, the church once again faced persecution. It's mind-boggling. It's a staggering series of events. The second fall was complete. And it is in that fallen world, deeply fallen, twice fallen, that we now live. Religious observance is in decay. Key beliefs are being abandoned. Previously expected marks of behavior are being dropped. What once was in a closet is now a parade. It's a serious time. Now, some at this point, I know, throw up their hands in despair. In fact, I had a friend send me something, one of those classic little internet stories that float around, but this one was actually worth keeping. It's an old story about during the days of pirates and buccaneers, there was a seaman named Captain Bravo, and he was one of those manly men, and he showed no fear when he faced his enemies. And one day while they were out sailing the seven seas, one of his lookouts spotted a pirate ship. And when this was announced, the crew became absolutely frantic, but not Captain Bravo. He said, "Bring me my red shirt." One of them went and got his red shirt, and he put it on, and then he led his shipmates into battle, and they defeated the pirates. Later on, the lookout spotted not one but two pirate ships coming. And again, the captain shouted for his red shirt, and he put it on, and though outnumbered, he led the men to victory. And as they were resting on the deck, reflecting on the day, one of the men said, "Captain Bravo, what is with the red shirt? I mean, why were you asking for that and putting it on?" And he said, "If I am wounded in the attack, the shirt will not show my blood so that you men will continue to resist unafraid." And all of the men sat back in silence and marveled at the courage of Captain Bravo. Suddenly the lookout called down. He spotted not one, not two, but 10 pirate ships headed their way. And the men turned to the captain, hoping that he would call for his red shirt. And he looked with steely eyes upon the vast armada arrayed against him. And he turned to the crew and said, "Bring me my brown pants." I think that story is okay in this context. I don't think it's time for the pants. Because while it is a serious time, it's also a time of opportunity. It's a momentous time. Because the world is feeling the sickness of its disease. The Enlightenment Project did not deliver. We face a crisis in values. We find ourselves having to need them and wanting them, but we don't have them, and we're divorced from any means of finding them. There's a lack of vision. There's nothing calling us upward to be more than we are beyond ourselves. We have very empty souls, and everything we have built apart from God has proven inadequate for human existence. So we have a world that's operating apart from God, but it can't. I mean, it's breaking down. That's the world's great crisis. If you're familiar with Nietzsche's famous phrase that God is dead, we're really not plagued by that. We're not plagued by Nietzsche's claim God is dead. If you continue reading that passage of Nietzsche, he goes on to say something else. He went on to say, and we have killed him. And how shall we, the murderer of all murderers, ever find comfort? Interesting. We've killed God in our modern world. Our problem is that now we do not know how to live with ourselves having done it. And that's the heart of what many are calling the postmodern condition. Now, I think there's a lot of confusion about postmodernity. There is a growing sense that something is beginning to take hold of our culture that's new, something different than the modern world created by the Enlightenment. But it's not so much the end of modernity as its exhaustion. Whether it's art or politics, literature or music, it all seems so tired. It's as if the currents of postmodernism are the Monday morning hangover, you know, the morning after hangover from the binge that we went on. It's as if we're trying to sort out the night before so that we can get a handle on the day at hand, almost as if saying to ourselves, dear God, what have we done? And what have we come to? Frederick Buechner tells the story of a boy who's about 12 or 13 who, in a fit of crazy anger and depression, got hold of a gun and shot and killed his father. When the authorities asked the boy why he had done it, he said it was because he couldn't stand his father, because his father was stupid. His father demanded too much of him because he was always after him. He said, I hate my father. But he was placed in a house of detention, and a guard was walking down the corridors one night when he heard sounds from the boy's room. And he paused outside the door to listen, and the words that the boy was sobbing in the dark was, I want my father. I want my father. In many ways, that captures the heart of people today, which is why we live in a day of peril and promise. I mean, the spiral of history from the medieval to the Enlightenment has, in countless and startling ways, been decisively downward. We live in a world that barely knows Christ, is barely touched by his life and teaching, and every day knows and is touched by him less than the day before. And if that is not understood, you have got to get out of your evangelical subculture and get out there in the real world and get very frightened. Yet the serious nature of our day holds enormous promise. And that's where Buechner's story rings true. In fact, Buechner himself observes that the story of the boy is a kind of parable for our lives. We as a culture have killed our father, and now we're sobbing in the dark for him. We're feeling the emptiness that it brings. We want him back. And that's where we come in, I hope. Soren Kierkegaard wrote of a fire that broke out backstage in a theater, and the clown came out to inform the audience. They thought it was part of the show. They thought it was a joke, and they applauded his announcement that a fire had broken out. And he repeated his warning, but they shouted all the louder, and Kierkegaard concludes, so I think the world will come to an end amid general applause from everyone who thinks it's just a joke. But the demise of the world is not a joke. It is the challenge of our day, and responding as Christ followers is the great call on our lives. The serious nature of our day has provided what I would characterize as a kairos moment. And how we live and act in response to it right now takes on new meaning and new urgency. Now, let me tell you what I mean by kairos. The sense of kairos time was much more familiar to the ancients than to us moderns. They had, the Greeks particularly, besides having the common word for time, which was chronos, where we get our word chronological, they had another term for time called kairos, and we don't have an English equivalent for what they were trying to get at. Kairos is time filled with opportunity, a moment pregnant with eternal significance and possibility. And it's all throughout the Bible, interestingly, though often we don't pull it out even in our Greek exegesis. In the book of, or even in our Hebrew, because it was used there in terms of the Septuagint. In the book of Jeremiah, Pharaoh is talked about as a king who was only a loud noise and nothing more because he had missed his moment. In the New Testament, we find Jesus talking about specific times of testing that await all who receive the Word of God that will determine faith's final outcome. Oz Guinness, reflecting on this, writes that nothing is more critical than to recognize and respond to these moments before our will hardens into faith, before choice becomes might have been. The Kairos hour is the moment when the present is at its greatest intensity and the future is uniquely open to our decision and our action. But how to live? You know, how to respond? You could get angry at what's happening and go on the warpath and try to defeat culture. Historically, that's failed. It's never worked. And it usually ends up into retreat rather than engagement. You could give it into all, just give into all of it, compromise the message, water down the gospel, sell out to culture. There's a word for that. It's called heresy. Or there's a third alternative that goes against both a Christ against culture position and a Christ of culture position, and it is, if you're going to play with Niebuhr's categories, Christ the transformer of culture. And for Christ to become the transformer of culture, we need transformed lives through which to work. Jesus initiated the great revolution through the cross, but then he entrusted the message of the cross to men and women. And they were not particularly educated. They were not particularly sophisticated. They were not wealthy or influential, at least not many of them. But that was not what was most needed. Engagement with the world demanded one thing, being like him. And the heart of Jesus' strategy for transforming the world was unleashing a force of transformed lives. And that's how the world will be changed. Individuals who have had their lives touched by Christ, turning around and touching the lives of other people. It is not that pursuing, you know, cultural agendas through various political or social processes are unimportant. Yes, get out there and tell people to vote their values. But before people can vote their values, they got to have values to vote. I mean, you know, we have to not get the cart before the horse. And a Christian nation is not forged primarily through legislation anyway. A Christian nation is not even the first goal. As if the mission is to steer culture toward a theocracy. No, the primary goal is not a Christian nation, it's a nation of Christians, which will then create, see, a Christian nation, which can shape the whole heart of a nation toward these Christian values. So we have to get back to the words of Jesus. Be salt and light in a revolutionary way in a fallen world. The heart of Jesus' strategy was transforming the world by unleashing a force of transformed lives. That's how the world will be changed. But what kind of Christian is that going to take? The world is full of Christ followers, particularly in the United States. This is a fascinating and also discouraging thing sometimes to reflect upon. The world's full of Christ followers. The United States is chock full of Christians, committed ones. I'm not going to point the finger and say they're lukewarm. I think there's a lot of terribly committed Christians in the United States. But the tide is not turning. And so I've wrestled with much of my Christian life. Why? Is it something we are? Is it something about how we live? Is it about how we think? Is it about our action? And the answer, of course, is yes. It's all of those things. But it's also something more. Because I think those questions often miss the larger journey. We have got to begin with basic investments, basic preparations that enlarge our capacities to be used strategically by God. And from that, we can be developed and matured and strengthened and made ready. And then there has to come a conscious, intentional positioning of our life, which situates our life for maximum action and impact. There are key outposts that we have to station ourselves at by which and from which we can act and respond and be used by God. And the more I have reflected on this, and the book you've been given explores some of this in detail, there are two key investments I'm convinced that have to be made. Our minds and our souls. And the outposts, two key outposts. The front lines of kingdom advance have always been made through two areas. People fulfilling their vocation in the world and taking their place in the body of Christ, the church. And all four of those sound very quick, very easy. Well, soul, mind, vocation, church, yada, yada, yada. We haven't even begun to fathom what those four mean. What it means to really have a deepened soul, to really have a Christian mind, to really understand what it means to answer our calling and pursue our vocation and align ourselves with the church, maybe particularly among evangelicals, because we have probably the lowest, weakest ecclesiology of any Christian group. Peter Kreeft once observed that the deepest reason why the church is weak and the world is decaying at its alarming rate is that there are not enough saints. And then he added, no, that's not quite honest. The reason is that we are not saints. We are not saints, but we can be. We really can deepen our souls and just allow this wellspring of God to fill us and to surface and have something to offer the world that it does not already have. And we can develop our minds so that we can truly engage the worldviews that right now are just assaulting the citadels of faith. Not simply defend Christianity, not just pull out pop apologetics, but to be able to present Christianity as a winsome and compelling alternative. We've got to respond to God's call on our life in such a way as that we really are taking our place in this world and filling it with the aroma and the agenda of Christ. And we've got to align ourselves with the church so that we are in the heart and the heat of the battle. Because make no mistake, the church is in the vanguard. You cannot read the Bible and find any ministry that is outside of the church. You can't do it. So Christians have got to become more Christian, which means discipleship. And in our time, at least my contribution, is to talk about how we might think about discipling ourselves and others along just two lines, Christian mind and Christian soul. And it will matter, I think, if we can get our arms around it. Because discipleship for our day is not just a nice idea. Along with evangelism, it is a radical urgency. Because an undiscipled Christian is a passive Christian. They're a marginalized Christian. They're an impotent Christian. And they will not make an impact. So as Chuck Colson has said, there is the Great Commission. There's also the Cultural Commission. And they are meant to go hand in hand. In the ancient world, stirring to reflect on it, you know, the influences of Christians acting as salt and light, they brought a stop to infanticide, ended slavery, liberated women, created hospitals, orphanages, and schools. During the medieval era, Christianity kept classical culture alive through the copying of manuscripts, as Cahill explores in How the Irish Saved Civilization. We built libraries. We invented colleges and universities. In the modern era, Christians led the way in the development of science and political and economic freedom, provided what is arguably the greatest source of inspiration for art and literature and music. What will Christians do in our day? And the great danger is nothing. Nothing. I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly a few months back where the author was describing his spiritual condition. Fascinating article. Someone asked him, he wrote, about his religion. And he said that he started to say atheist, but then he caught himself and realized that that wasn't really quite accurate. He said, I used to call myself an atheist, and I still don't believe in God, but the larger truth is that it has been years since I cared, one way or another. In truth, he said, I'm an apatheist. He then went on to describe his condition as a disinclination to care all that much about his own religion, and not really caring about anybody else's either. But it's what he wrote next in his article that haunted me. He said, I have Christian friends who organize their lives around an intense and personal relationship with God, but who betray no sign of caring that I am an unrepentantly atheistic Jewish homosexual. They are exponents of another part of apatheism, the part that doesn't mind what other people think about God either. Now that's the great danger for as Vaclav Havel wrote to his wife in one of his letters. He said, it's not the authors of absurd plays or pessimistic poems. It's not the suicides. It's not the people constantly afflicted by anger or boredom or anxiety and despair. It's not the alcoholics. It's not the drug addicts who have, in the deepest sense, lost their way and lost their grip on the meaning of life and have become non-believers. It's the people who are apathetic. But there's another way to live. I like the music of Canadian singer and songwriter Bruce Coburn, and he once wrote a song called Lovers in a Dangerous Time. And in that song, he says, and he writes as a Christian, that we need to kick at the darkness until it bleeds daylight. We need to be kicking at the darkness until it bleeds daylight. The purpose of understanding the serious nature of our time is to then undertake a serious life. A life that will not only understand the times, but then be moved to act within them for Christ. And we'll explore two of those areas, a deepened soul and then a developed life.